Who's going to help me do a little review? A theme from Hebrews?
Jesus is better.
Jesus is better. So it's a letter, right? And it's to the Hebrews. And the guy writing it, the point he's trying to make is, we've got this whole understanding of God and sacrifice and stuff's going on, but Jesus is better. So Jesus is a better messenger. Jesus is a better priest, a better sacrifice, and he's mediating a better covenant. Anybody remember one of the other main themes in Hebrews? There was a band called This in the 80s. Don't Stop Believing. Journey! Okay, journey is one of the big themes in the book of Hebrews. And there's lots of... Some of it's subtle, it's just word choices. But some of it's like, hey, we're on a journey together. So those are some of the things that we've been talking about. And also we'll talk about this morning in chapter 12. Well, I'll talk briefly, as I have been, about what comes before it. But mostly we're in chapter 12 today. I cannot resist a good therefore. First word in my translation in chapter 12 is therefore. Have I said it enough times you can help me out? When you see therefore, you're going to take a look and see what it's there for. And that's kind of what we were already talking about. It's there for, because it's sort of like, okay, you've got these 11 chapters already. And with all of that in mind, therefore, and he launches into the rest. And specifically with chapter 11, he's gone on about, chapter 11 is kind of known as the faith chapter, right? And it's listing people. This guy was faithful. This guy was faithful. Rahab was faithful. This other guy was faithful. And with all that in mind, therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us. Running the race is kind of a journey. It's not kind of quite the same thing, but it is a bit of a journey. And because we're not doing Summer Olympics, we're doing Winter Olympics, this reminded me of this guy. I'm talking about the strip off everything that entangles, everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles. Do you remember this guy?
It's Pete Seeger.
Yes.
Is it a current one or an old one?
This is an older one. I noticed after I printed it, he's not wearing a helmet. This is from, I think, this is either 84 or 1980. Yes, I'm amazed a little bit that anyone knew that. Apparently Quebec's got the program because they were winning medals last night too, those guys from Quebec. So I have no idea if they're connected with this guy. But Gaétan Boucher, for some reason, I had a playing card, kind of a trading card of Gaétan Boucher. I think I was in grade 6. And I don't know why I had it, but I remember, I think it was this picture actually. I remember just staring at those gigantic quads and thinking about how powerful that guy must be and how it's just him and his skates and this intense, fierce look, right? And this is what I thought of when I read the verse, actually. Just, he is not carrying any extra weight. This guy's not even wearing a helmet. They make you wear the helmets now. But it's just him and his big muscles and hardly anything else. And that's the image that came to my mind for just run. If you want to run, you got to pack light on this journey of faith. So strip off the sin that so easily entangles. Don't try and race wearing your parka. It's warmer, but golly, it's bulky, and you're not going to make speed that way. As we're stripping off those things that entangle, the reference is to the people in chapter 11, right? That big crowd of spectators, the people that have finished their race, that crowd is surrounding us, and we can be encouraged to be like them. And they inspire us with our stories. I was kind of inspired by Gaétan. I was never into the speed skating. Maybe you can guess, there wasn't a club where I was from either, but still, it was inspiring. Like, this guy really, like, he goes to the Olympics because he trained, and I'm thinking about that as a kid, we're like, okay, that's kind of an inspiration. And we can be inspired by the folks in chapter 11, the faithful saints that have gone before us, watching our progress and cheering us on. So you have questions like, well, how do I run well? How do I live a life of faith? And verse 2, let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Let us fix our eyes on Jesus. That's the short answer. How do you live a life well? How do you live a life of faith? Keep your eye on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, because Jesus is a better model. He's a better leader. He's the one who started the faith, and he's the one who shows us how to live out our faith. He's the one to follow. Don't be distracted by the sin that so easily entangles. Don't look at your feet. Look up and follow our pioneer, the one who leads us with a better example of how to live well. And sometimes that's hard. We talked a little bit about that already this morning. Sometimes it's hard to stay focused. For all kinds of reasons. The demands of daily living, people around us make choices we'd rather they didn't make. There's health issues, we have addictions, bad habits. All these are like hecklers in the crowd. They're just noisy. This is the guy with the cowbell right by the rink. Like, that's not helping. But they distract us from running well. The next few verses, I really wanted to be like, hey, I can tie this in and talk about God as a coach. And he's guiding us and helping us stay focused. Probably all those things are true, but they're not in this passage. As much as I wanted them to be, the passage is more like God's handing out correction for bad behavior. And I wiggle at that one, I'll admit, that I don't like the thought of God being someone that needs to discipline me. Maybe I don't like to admit that I'm doing it wrong, anything wrong. I don't like the idea that God's the one that smacks my hand with the ruler. That image is completely unappealing to me. And I looked and looked and I read it, and that's what it says. Some of the things that happen in my life are put there by God to get my attention and correct my behavior. Which, shockingly enough, isn't perfect, right? But like we were saying this morning already, several times, God's for us. It's not because he's mad at us that he's punishing us. It's precisely because God is for us that he cares enough to correct. He's not going to turn a blind eye if it hurts our feelings. He's willing to hurt my feelings a bit to say, look, this, I know it's not fun at the moment, but it's worth it eventually. In verse 11, it tells us there will be a peaceful harvest of right living for those who are trained in this way. Nobody likes to be punished, but if that's where we are, keep your eye on the goal, because it will be worth it in the end. So take heart. Verse 12 tells us, therefore, strengthen your feeble arms and weak knees. Make level paths for your feet, so that the lame may not be disabled, but rather healed. Take heart. Verse 12 is telling us to be bold and courageous and endure hardship because of the goal in mind. Hold fast with your tired hands. And verse 13, encourage those around you. I worked with someone who would often tell us in the office to leave things better for the next guy. And she was talking about leaving good project notes, right? If I get hit by a bus, you guys need to know what I was working on so you can keep doing the project. She would say that fairly often. Leave things better for the next guy was the point. And I think that's what's being said here. It applies to looking out for the other folks on the journey of faith. Watch out for each other. If somebody is lagging behind, do what you can to smooth their path. Do what you can to keep them from falling down. It's the community idea. It's not just me. It's not like so many Olympic sports where it's just it's me, and I gotta beat the rest of you, and I don't care if you slide off into the stands, I just need to cross the line first. Well, no, that's not really it. It's about, we're all traveling together. It's more like, in the first couple chapters, was talking about a colony going out. You're all moving together, and you're all looking out for each other, and a rising tide raises all ships. You all succeed because of your collective efforts. So run well. Okay, so here's what we just did. Chapter 1 to 4, verses 1 to 4, 5 to 7, 7 to 9, 10 to 11, 12 and 13. He's kind of talking about the same things at those points. Yeah, chapter 12, verse 14 starts with this idea about holiness. Make every effort to live in peace with all men and to be holy. Without holiness, no one will see the Lord. Does anybody have a different translation? Did it sound really different when you were reading along? I have a different translation in my note. Work at living in peace with everyone and work at living a holy life. Or you might say, I think one translation says, pursue living at peace with everyone. And I decided that's a little bit soft. It's not like, do you remember this guy's catchphrase? Every time on the CB, I'm in hot pursuit, hot pursuit. With an accent I can't do, I don't try this one at all. But of course, this is Roscoe P. Coltrane, who never ever caught that charger with the Duke Boys in it. Remember? Anyway, he's in hot pursuit. This is the lame kind of pursuit that I'm trying to make a point about. I'm thinking more when it's in this verse, particularly, work at living in peace sounds like, okay, he works at being a sheriff. That's not what it's saying. It's more like this guy, you get bonus points if you figure out who this is. He's in Sam Steele. He's famous because he always got his man, right? Is this the guy?
Yeah.
Okay. This guy never caught his man. This guy always caught his man. So I'm thinking this is, when you're looking in this verse, this is a pursue. It's more like hunt down. It's more like keep at it like a bulldog. Don't let go of this. I will follow you across Alaska if I have to and drag you back to the post. Pursue living at peace with everyone and pursue living a holy life. For those who are not holy will not see the Lord. Look after each other so that none of you falls to receive the grace of God. Watch out that no poisonous root of bitterness grows up to trouble you, corrupting men. So for some reason I thought maybe this is a verse I should paint on the outside of my house. Work out living in peace with everyone. Or even just that much of it. But once you put the paint up, you're kind of committed to actually doing it, right? I'd better be ready to follow through. So maybe I should do it. And it would keep me on my toes. And keep me doing a better job of it. And I wonder, it says work at living and work at living, right? So when it's that close, in the same verse, work at living in peace, work at living a holy life. Is it two ways of saying the same thing? Maybe, and if it's not the same, I don't think I wholly live and happens if I am holding a grudge with my neighbor. I don't think I can do both. Maybe they're not the same thing, but am I really pursuing a holy life if you can sort of fill in the blanks? If I am not a good neighbor to the guy who literally lives next door. If I'm mad at him because of a thing he did that one time. Do you remember? Oh, that thing. Really? Is that holy living? Probably not. So here's the second half of Hebrews chapter 12. He starts out talking about generally. There's kind of five paragraphs. First one, he's talking about holiness. And then we're talking about mountains. Mount Sinai, right? And then the goal. This is the point of the whole series right here. The goal, right, of the journey. That the whole imagery is all leading to this part. So Mount Zion, we're encountering it in, like, as early as verse 18. You have not come to a mountain that can be touched and is burning with fire, to gloom and darkness and storm, to a trumpet blast, or to a voice speaking words to those, a voice speaking words that those who heard it begged no further word be given to them. Right? That sounds sort of familiar from what we're in Exodus. They come to the mountain, and it's a big deal. And the sight was so terrifying, verse 21 says, Moses said, I am trembling with fear. You have not come to that mountain. But verse 22 tells us, guess what, it's a better mountain. You've come to Zion. In a way, it's a bunch bigger and possibly scarier than what we read about with the fire and the whirlwind and everything. But it's better. Some of you have probably heard me singing. So you know, I am not a musician. And you may or may not know, I'm not a poet, but I think even I can tell that these verses, and I'm talking about verses 22 to 24, the ones I kind of started just reading, you have come to Mount Zion, to the heavenly Jerusalem. This is the crescendo. That's a $5 word that I learned somewhere. The crescendo, and most of you know more about it than I do. It's the peace in music. The peace has been sort of building, sort of building, sort of building, and it's building up to something. So I'm thinking of like that 1812 overture. It's the one that's like, with the canons in it,
yes, right.
Right? So this is the canons, these three verses. He's been building, da-da-da, da-da-da, and he's building and building, and then boom, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, boom! And he's... We read in Psalm 1, this happens in the lots of the Psalms. I do not walk, I do not stand, I do not sit. Well, it's the same thing three times, right? He's not really doing three different things. He's doing it for emphasis. And you'll find it all through the Psalms particularly, but anytime they say, or in Proverbs, three things the Lord hates, four things that really make him mad. We're like, well, the number is not really the point. It's he said something and then emphasizes it. At the crescendo, the whole thing leads up to, not two, not three, nine things. Boom! Boom! He's got cannons going now. Nine things. I'll go ahead and I'll read them all in verse 22, you've come to Mount Zion, to the heavenly Jerusalem, the city of the living God. You have come to thousands upon thousands of angels in joyful assembly, to the church of the firstborn, whose names are written in heaven. You have come to God, the judge of all men, to the spirits of righteous men made perfect, to Jesus, the mediator of the new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood that speaks a better word than the blood of Abel. Boom, boom, boom. It's hard to ignore what he's doing here. He's making an enormous point about, hey, we've been talking about journey. This is the end of the journey, folks. You have arrived. You've arrived at something better than you ever could have hoped or planned for. You have come because of the better priest who mediates a better covenant by his own better sacrifice and the blood that speaks of vengeance, rather, the blood of Christ speaks forgiveness. Which leads us to the great question, so what? What do we do with it? This is great, and now what? Because our beliefs are betrayed by our actions. So what we're going to do with this information about the end of our journey? It actually tells us what to do about it in verse 25. Do not ignore the one who speaks. See to it that you do not refuse him who speaks. It's about listening, but it's kind of a bigger version of listening. It's be careful, do not refuse to listen. This is a willful disobedience, right? The sacrifice of Jesus speaks of forgiveness and draws us into holy living. Do not ignore that voice. This isn't, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. This is, yeah, I heard you fine, and I'm not going to do it because I don't want to. Do not refuse to listen to the one who is speaking. The covenant we've talked about a couple of times, and it makes us co-heirs with Jesus. Jesus is the firstborn among brothers. We are co-heirs with Jesus, the first of a family. What's the point of being an heir? You inherit something. Okay, what are we receiving? Verse 28, we are receiving a kingdom. Maybe I should just stop there and think about that for 10 minutes. We are receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken. Let us be thankful and so worship God acceptably with reverence and awe, for our God is a consuming fire. We didn't buy it. We didn't earn it. This unshakable kingdom is something we are in the process of receiving. This unshakable kingdom we receive for nothing that I've done. What can I do except to say thank you? Be thankful and worship God with holy fear. Our God is a consuming fire. Is our God safe? No, by no means. But he's good. Because of the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ, we have an unshakable relationship with a holy, powerful God. We can come boldly to the throne of grace, not because of anything we have done or can do. We can only come because Jesus went before us and leads us on our journey of faith. Jesus sits at the right hand of God, now and always, and speaks on our behalf. Each of us is like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. In the book of Daniel, Nebuchadnezzar said, okay, I'm really mad at you, and you can put them in. And what happened? Did they burn up in the fiery furnace? They didn't at all. In fact, text tells us, they didn't even smell of smoke. This is the same image that's coming to my mind when we're standing in the furnace of God's holiness, and yet, somehow, we are not burned up. Why?
Somebody's with us.
Somebody is with us. Three men went in, and now I see four. Who's there with them? In our case, we come boldly to the throne of a holy God, and we are not burned up because Jesus has gone ahead of us and sits at the right hand of God the Father Almighty, and in ways I cannot completely understand, keeps me from being burned up by God's holiness. Otherwise, I can't come at all, much less come boldly, which the text says, come boldly to the throne of grace. It allows us to have a relationship with a God that is too big to even understand. Run well, brothers and sisters. Run in the long journey of faith, confident that we follow a better messenger, a better priest, who offers a better sacrifice and stands with us in the very presence of God.